Hello, this is Terrence McNally. The 2024 elections, the candidates, campaigns, results, and reactions will test American democracy like nothing in recent memory, and that's saying a lot following 2020. So last week I talked with Sam Daly Harris about the life-tested lessons in his book Reclaiming Our Democracy, Every Citizen's Guide to Transformational Advocacy. I recommend the book and the episode. And I follow it this week with my 2017 conversation with Francis Moore LePay and Adam Eichen about the inspiring local movements they encounter in their book, Daring Democracy, Igniting Power, Meaning, and Connection for the America We Want. It's about engaged citizenship that is multi-generational and solutions-focused. This is their report on pro-democracy activism near the end of Trump's first year in office. A good two generations separate LePay, the best-selling author 50-plus years ago of Diet for a Small Planet, and Eichen. They met on a march and decided to write this book together. Hello, I'm Terrence McNally. Welcome to Free Forum, a world that just might work. I'm joined today by Francis Moore LePay and Adam Eichen, co-authors of Daring Democracy, Igniting Power, Meaning, and Connection for the America We Want. Let me just say that after hosting and producing the show for nearly two decades in 2014, I stopped recording new live interviews. And the show continued on the Progressive Voices Network on TuneIn, streaming relevant interviews from the archives every week. And podcasts of all those years of interviews are available anytime, anywhere on iTunes, Podomatic.com, and at my site, which has two different names, TerrenceMcNally.net, TerrenceMcNally.net, or aworldthatjustmightwork.com. They're the same site. Now, folks who listen to this show have probably heard me talk about something I call 60s 2.0. I'm not the first to notice that young people today share many of the values of young people in the 60s, questioning consumption, valuing balance, caring for nature, spiritual but maybe not religious, money's not the most important thing, liberation and justice for all, African Americans, Latinos, Native Americans, immigrants, LGBTQ, etc., war as a last resort, leaders not necessarily to be trusted, not accepting what our parents offered us, and believing change is possible. But it excites me to see that I believe there are a few things that can improve their chances to build something more sustainable than we were able to. First, the technology that makes it easier to reduce our material consumption, easier to interact with diverse others unbound by geography. You're not the only one who feels that way, no matter what small town you might live in, because you can connect with your peers and your allies online. Second, the millions of our generation that will welcome, support, and join them. In the 60s, I say there were maybe 100 beats in Greenwich Village and 100 in the San Francisco Bay Area. Basically, we were on our own. The generation gap was real. But today, that's not the case. And boomers who might have been activists in the 60s have more time, more experience, and probably more money to offer. And there are millions more in generations in between. Third, organizations and movements in the 60s were dominated by males. Today, we can tap the genius and energy of women and others whose voices were not listened to in those days. So I think those three factors bring more chances of both success and the sustainable success than they did in the 60s. I've also talked for years, at least since the 2004 election, of what I believe this country needs more than anything else, the Restore Democracy Trifecta: campaign finance reform, media reform, and election reform. Now, Francis Moore LePay and Adam Eichen actually bring a lot of those notions to life. These two met on a march, first of all. Francis, or Frankie, whose work for decades has, I would say, consistently updated the best of what the 60s had to offer, and Adam, who graduated from college in 2015. They quickly committed to working together, and they have written one of the clearest books I've read about how our democracy is broken, how it got broken, and how it can be fixed. Not only that, how we're already fixing it in cities, states, and communities all over the country. That book is Daring Democracy, Igniting Power, Meaning, and Connection for the America We Want. Francis Morlepay is the author or co-author of 19 books about world hunger, living democracy, and the environment, beginning with the 3 million copy Diet for a Small Planet in 1971. She's a contributor to Huffington Post and BillMoyers.com and a contributing editor at Yes Magazine and Solutions Journal. She's a co-founder of three organizations, Food First, the Small Planet Institute, which she leads with her daughter, Anna LePay, and the Small Planet Fund, which channels resources to democratic social movements worldwide. Over the years, she's won numerous awards, including 18 honorary doctorates. She co-wrote her latest book, as I said, Daring Democracy, with Adam Eichen, a member of the Democracy Matters Board of Directors and a fellow at the Small Planet Institute. Adam served as the Deputy Communications Director for Democracy Spring in 2016. Welcome again, Francis Morlepay, to Free Forum, A World That Just Might Work.
Thank you so much, Terrence.
And welcome, Adam Eichen.
Thanks for having me.
Okay. So let me tell listeners that we're recording this conversation on Wednesday, November 29th, in case events race past us before you actually hear this. So I like listeners to get a feel for the people behind the work and the ideas that we talk about. So Francis, first, how do you see your path to the work you're doing these days? I mentioned some of the highlights, but why did you focus on Food First, for example? And then how did you shift to the broader questions of democracy? And feel free to mention turning points, mentors, moments of division, that sort of thing.
Okay. Well, I am a child of the 60s, for sure. And I loved your comparisons, your contrasts. I agree with you and more. I was part of the war on poverty. I was a covert agent, however, meaning that I was hired by the city of Philadelphia in the mid-60s on the ruse, in a way, of being an inspector. That was my job title, a housing inspector. But my real job was going door-to-door organizing for the Welfare Rights Organization, because the idea, I think, of my bosses was that, you know, they were trying to help low-income people emerge into home ownership and their own power. But how could they do that if they weren't organized and had solidarity with their neighbors? So I went door to door. That was my job. But, you know, I got crushed. My heart was crushed when the woman I worked most closely with died of a heart attack in her 40s. And I was convinced this African-American woman trying to bring up her kids, the stress of it was just impossible. And I was convinced she died of poverty, not of heart attack. So that's how I finally got to somehow the point where I said, okay, I'm not going to try to save the world until I understand more. And out of that decision, which was terrifying to me, I left graduate school in community organizing. I thought, food. If I could really understand why people are hungry, that would unlock the mysteries of economics and politics, and it would be, I would find the path. So I sat in the UC Berkeley library and literally put two to two together using my dad's slide rule. I made calculations and learned that, wait a minute, hunger is not caused by scarcity of food. There's plenty of food. Ultimately, I came to see it's caused by a scarcity of democracy. People don't have a voice, so they don't have food. And that was really the beginning of my adult life, of the quest of keeping on that path. And so I've been swimming in, I like to say, one river with two currents, and one is democracy and one is food, because food is such a powerful entry point. It connects us all. We all have to eat. We can measure how much we need, and it connects us to the earth. And so it's always been a great entry point into this fundamental question of who decides, and that is the question of democracy itself. So is that good enough in terms of how I got to be marching on a march with this 24-year-old sitting with me now?
That's pretty close, but let me see if I can tease out a little more. What I see over, and you can correct me, over the last 10, 12, 15 years is really the focus is democracy and restoring democracy, sort of very much, as I said, that sort of trifecta that I've been talking about, which is campaign finance reform, media reform, and voting and election reform. I would say I don't see too many other people really banging the drum for democracy so consistently as you have. Any thoughts about how that became the thrust. In other words, part of that would be that some people would have stuck with one issue, food or homelessness or health care. And you instead took, I say, sort of a step up to, wait, at the root of all of those things is democracy. What sort of led to that?
Well, it was really a direct response to realizing, to discovering that we were duped with this notion of scarcity, that there's not enough, and that actually there was enough. There's more than enough then and now, even more so, if we come together and make decisions in such a way that we all have access to that plenty. So it wasn't a big leap in that sense. The challenge was, you know, when I would stand at the podium way back in the 80s and say, you know, the root of hunger is not scarcity of food, but scarcity of democracy, I could see the eyes of my audience saying, okay, lady, show me where there is democracy that's strong enough to end hunger. And from there, I had to keep going deeper, and I founded something, co-founded something called the Center for Living Democracy. And that's still the meme I use, that democracy can't work if it's simply a structure of government that we think about a few times a year. It's a way of life. And I hope we bring out, Adam and I, in Daring Democracy, that it is a thrilling way of life and that it meets our deepest need for voice, for power, that is, our need for connection with one another and our need for purpose in our lives. That so it's really was never a big step for me to say the words, you know. The step for me that has been challenging is how do I do that? How do I help create democracy? And what's so thrilling for me now, Terrence, is that I feel so many others across the issues, and this is really the theme song of our book, is that people from racial justice movements, from environment, from food, from you name it, you see people saying, wait a minute, going issue by issue is no longer enough, and that's really the key idea of our book, this movement of movements. And so now at Democracy Spring, that was one of the happiest weeks of my life, where I felt in 2016, as we marched from Philadelphia to D.C., that, oh, wow, other people, we're all in this together. We're not giving up our issues, but we are focusing together on the root of it all, the mother of all issues, democracy.
Very good. And before we, I'm gonna turn to you, Adam, in 1 second, but before I do, I've mentioned that you've authored 19 books. One of your books that I've actually, that I interviewed you on, and by the way, at the website, you can find 2 or 3 interviews with Francis in the past, but one on your book, Echo Mind, and where Daring Democracy has big ideas, but it also has very practical, this is what's happening in Oregon, this is what's happening in Maine. Echo Mind was more, how do we look at things? Can you just share for a second what your book, Echo Mind, the message of it, because I think it's a really interesting approach.
Yes, thank you so much. Well, that was really coming also directly out of that aha moment in the UC Berkeley Library when I realized that scarcity was a false frame. And then over the decades, I realized, wait a minute, scarcity is not just a false frame about food, but about everything, including the environmental movement messaging to try to get people to act to save our planet often was couched in a fear. I feared it was a fear message of, oh, we've got to cut back, we've hit the limits. And I felt that so many people on this planet are already feeling that they're struggling, they're so trapped, that I wanted to suggest an alternative way of seeing, and that is from going from the limits frame, the scarcity frame, to a frame of alignment. That if we truly understand the world through the lens of ecology, through relationships. I love to quote Hans-Peter Dürer, the physicist in Germany, who said to me once, Frankie, in biological systems, there are no parts, there are only participants. Mm. So if we see ourselves connected, always interacting, and that if we then can grasp that as we align with the laws of nature, particularly in agriculture, for example, but also in energy in every way, that there's more than enough for all of us, so that we don't have to live in the fear frame of limits. You know, we banged our head against the wall somehow, and we have to cut back. that's not a very winning message. And so EcoMind is really about this kind of reframing, and I go through a number of reframes around the environmental messaging, but the core one is to shed this fear frame of scarcity and to move into an alignment frame in which we are all connected. Change is the only constant, and therefore we are all co-creators together of our reality. Mm-hmm. And then we can move into a mutual accountability instead of the blaming culture that is so much of an impediment today.
Yeah, it's almost like you ask at any point, what would nature do? How would nature handle this? And so I've dealt with biomimicry and that notion. It's often thought of mainly in a technological thing. You know, how do you, build ceramics that are as strong as abalone shells? But I think what you're doing in EcoMind is saying it not only applies to technologies, but it applies to processes, it applies to systems, and that we begin to view our communities, our families, our societies as ecosystems, we'll see that cutthroat competition is not actually what's going on at the ecosystem level, but that it's much more, as you say, alignment and cooperation. So Adam, you've been walking your path many less years than either Frankie or myself, but how do you see the evolution of your own life and work?
Well, that's certainly true. Just to be completely candid, I'm, at the time of this recording, only 24 years old, but soon to be 25. But I've already seen, quite a bit in the emergence of this democracy movement that we write about. And my path to democracy and focusing on election policy has been different than Frankie's, although really not that different, because I started as a freshman in college. I went to Vassar College. I grew up in New York City, and I was politically minded, not necessarily politically active. And it just so happened that in basically my first 3 weeks of college in 2011, the Occupy Wall Street movement broke out. And I actually was there on the very first day, and it was the first protest that I'd ever been to. And I went back a couple times, and it was a really formative moment for me. It really is the moment where politics became real. It's not just a heady experience, but it's what determines the livelihood of the people who live on this planet and in our country. And I met people whom I'd never meet before, would have never met before. And it really was the first time that I came up against riot police and police suppression that really changed my entire mindset about what it was that I wanted to do. And it became very clear that I had only one option, and it was to try and make the world a little bit of a better place than the one that I found. And the only problem was that as I learned more and more about the United States political system, the more and more I realized I wanted to change everything, but I couldn't focus on everything. That is until I realized the following year when I joined an organization and led it my sophomore year through my last year of college called Democracy Matters, which taught me very concretely that I actually could fight for everything, all the issues that I cared about, to make a progressive America, to make an America that works for all. I just had to focus on democracy, that the biggest hindrance to preventing climate change, to ensuring health care for all, to ensuring a livable wage, was democracy. It was special interest groups spending billions of dollars preventing the change that most Americans want. And it was through that realization, and I remember it incredibly vividly. It was in the first month of my sophomore year of college, the executive director of Democracy Matters, Joan Mandel, who was an organizer in the 60s. She was actually, she went to Vassar College, and she dropped out in, I think, 1963 to go join the Freedom Rides. And she's been was a professor at Colgate, and she's been an organizer her entire life. And she made it explicitly clear. She says, I've been working in this field a long time, and I realize it's democracy. We have to focus on this, and this is why. And when she outlined it, it just changed my life. I said, this is what I want to devote my life to. This is how I make the biggest difference I can. And so I stuck with it throughout college. I was appointed to the board of directors of Democracy Matters in 2015. And then I went abroad for a year because I wanted to know, so how do other countries deal with the issue of money in politics and drawing district lines and ensuring the right to vote? I wanted to know, there are many other democracies. I know that's a radical concept for a lot of American politicians. And so I said, what can we learn from other countries? And it was there that I realized that we have the solutions. We know what works. And it was halfway through my time there that I heard about Democracy Spring, which I'm sure we'll talk about, in April 2016, the march from Philadelphia to D.C., and then the 7 straight days of civil disobedience that I came back for, and that's really where Frankie and I became friends. And it was there when I was deputy communications director of that mobilization that it really became clear that someone had to write about this movement that was emerging across the country, that it, you know, we had to make it not invisible anymore, that there were Americans stepping up and fighting for democracy reform because they too saw it as the key issue to unleash the floodgate of all the change that we want to see in America.
Very good. Let me just share with you that at age 24, I was a part of the McGovern presidential campaign and ran an assembly district in Southern California. So, you know, started in this, what I felt was a pro-democracy movement myself at about the same age.
Right.
How did you two meet? Whoever wants to take it, you guys can signal to each other who's going to start an answer. How did you meet and how did you decide to write this book together?
Okay, well, we actually met in the rain at the airport in Mexico City. And we had both taken the leap to say, okay, we're going to show up for the first global conference on money and politics, actually initiated by an institute in Stockholm. But representatives from hundreds of governments were showing up. So hundreds of countries, I should say. So we had to be there to learn, right? So we met at the airport by accident, standing there, and started talking. And as we like to say, very accurately, we haven't stopped talking since. So that that was our opening, and we were kind of shocked at how little we had to contribute to the conversation there in Mexico City.
Yeah, I mean, that was actually really where we started to become friends, because, you know, at that conference, all of these, you know, brilliant minds from across the world were debating issues like, what is the best threshold off of which to offer public financing of elections? Like, how do you qualify for public financing? You know, what is the best way to reduce election costs and stuff like this? And all of the conversations were so outside of where we were in the United States. We were saying, what's the threshold for public financing? The question we have to ask is, how do we get public financing
right.
of elections?
Right.
And so, you know, the American contingent, there were really only a select few of us. We just kind of hung out with each other and had some really, you know, wonderfully deep conversations about, you know, our hopes and dreams for how to make our democracy in our own country more representative. And so Frankie and I got to know each other then. You know, we had a couple meals together and started these conversations. And as I said, it really was on that march from Philadelphia to D.C. in April 2016 where we became friends. I mean, I don't know if any of your listeners have ever been on a hike, let alone a 9-day march. There's not much to do except talk. No one had their earphones in. No one had, you know, a TV out. I mean, people were just talking. And there were about 150 of us marching that 140 miles. And the incredible thing is, you know, well, I mean, two incredible things. Everyone was talking. Every 30 minutes, people would change partners almost and talk to someone new and get a new, you know, life experience and you know, learn from them. But it soon became clear that, you know, Frankie and I continuously just kept talking. You know, throughout each day, we just pick up our conversations about, so what does a democracy look like in the United States? What are the things that we should be fighting for? And slowly but surely, we realized that being a part of Democracy Spring was actually was a bigger moment than I think anybody was really giving me a credit for. Because what it was kind of the emergence of the public face of this democracy movement. Because the thing about Democracy Spring, for your listeners who don't know, it was a mobilization that was endorsed by over 140 organizations. And these organizations range from labor groups to racial justice groups to environmental groups to this classic good government group. And so it was all of these issue groups who said, okay, we're not going to make progress on our issues until we fix democracy first, right? This core change in understanding about how do you organize in America. And these groups are realizing that we have to fix our democracy. And so when they came together to endorse Democracy Spring and another mobilization that came right after called Democracy Awakening, which had over 200 organizations endorsing it among some of the biggest players in American politics, it was really then that Frankie and I, you know, said, okay, there's something going on here. That the democracy movement, as we see it, is grassroots, but it's not just the traditional players. It's not just the usual suspects. Something's changing. And that was the basis for our book. We said we have to write about this real shift in organizing about democracy in America, that something amazing is happening and people don't know it.
Okay.
And one of the people who showed up on part of that march was a friend of ours, Josh Silver, who founded Represent Us. And he gave us a metaphor that explains a bit of what we were witnessing there was these issue groups actually coming together around democracy. He looked at me once and he said, "Frankie, you know you can love two children at once." And he knew I had two kids. And I said, "Oh, I get it. You know, I don't have to give up my food passion to be a democracy champion and stalwart." So we use that metaphor a lot. And I think a lot of us on that march were feeling that intuitively, that it wasn't about giving up an issue. It was about going deeper into that issue to go to the root.
Mm-hmm. Well, for those of you who do a little etymology, the root of the word radical is root. That to be radical is to approach something from the root. And most people think it's to be, you know, wild-eyed or way out on the fringe, but it's really to deal with roots. And the other thing I take from looking at nature is that if you want to solve a problem before it gets more and more complex and more difficult, you solve it upstream. And that's very much what this democracy movement is about. It's about, two metaphors you can use are looking at the root and looking upstream. So one quick question before we delve into the content, and that is, you found that you guys had no trouble talking, and especially talking when you were walking. But what's the working process together? How do two? One thing I will say about this book, Daring Democracy, I highly recommend it. One of the reasons I highly recommend it is it's only 163 pages. It is jam full of content, but you did a very good job of not just going on and on. What's your work? What's your writing process like?
Well, that's the kind of book we both like to read, first of all. So we had to write one that we'd want to read. Second of all, we were under an intense time pressure because of the results of the election to get this book out in September, get it out in the fall of this year. We had to work fast, and we had a clear word limit. But the beauty of our collaboration, the magic of it for me, many levels, but one of them is that Adam is the ultimate like policy guy, and which is fabulous. And I'm the big picture girl, and the narrative builder, so to speak. So we did not disagree on a single word, Terrence, in the entire book. And we joked that we did disagree on a word. It was on the back cover, and that word was "the." We couldn't decide whether it needed one or not. But literally, it was amazing, given our obviously different generations.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's absolutely true. I mean, the way I like to describe it is, I think we just both had a tremendous amount of faith in one another, that, you know, we could write something and then give it to the other person and say, "I trust you completely to do the best job with this. And I trust that you have the best intention for this book." Because ultimately, I think the reason we work so well together is that we both had this vision of what we wanted to express. We fundamentally wanted to show that there was a democracy movement, that we wanted to explain in very clear language, not in some wonky, hard to understand academic way about what the solutions are. We wanted to show that the America we want is possible. And so we were willing to do whatever it took to make it happen. And so, you know, our writing process really was one of just tremendous faith in one another. And that derives from just a shared belief in what we were writing about.
We truly
believe every word.
I've collaborated on screenplays and songs as well as other things. And I think one of the things that I learned early was that if you can both know that the work is the boss, that neither of you, your point of view is, but that the work you're creating will tell you what needs to be in and what doesn't need to be in and so on. And I'm clear that's what you're saying, is that you had such a clear vision of what was needed from the two of you that that overrode anything that might be individual. We're at about the halfway point. This is Free Forum, A World That Just Might Work. I'm Terrence McNally. I'm speaking with Francis Moore LePay and Adam Eichen. They're the authors together of Daring Democracy, Igniting Power, Meaning, and Connection for the America We Want. You can learn more at smallplanet.org, smallplanet1word.org, and fieldguidetodemocracy.org. Field Guide to Democracy is something that the Small Planet Institute has created that really is what it sounds like. So smallplanet.org and fieldguidetodemocracy.org.
Hello, this is Terrence McNally. You're listening to my 2017 conversation with Francis Moore LePay and Adam Eichen about their book, Daring Democracy, Igniting Power, Meaning, and Connection for the America We Want.
Okay. I have a format that I think I sometimes use that I think fits your book and the rest of this conversation very well. And that's, if something is broken, in this case, American democracy, how is it broken? What's the evidence? How did it get broken? What's the history? And how do we fix it? What are the solutions? Okay? So, first question, what is the evidence that our democracy is broken? I don't think you've got to sell it in a big way, but some of the things that stick out for you.
Well, I think that, the wonderful thing about writing this book is that on this question of how it's broken, it's not very controversial. The overwhelming consensus across America is exactly that people are powerless. And the data and the evidence shows exactly that. One of our favorite studies that we like to cite is a analysis of the years, the 1980s to early 2000s. And it shows that the average American citizen has near zero influence on public policy, whereas the wealthiest among us have significant influence.
And that was a study by Galen and what's the other person's name?
Gillens and Page.
Gillens and Page.
Professor.
Yeah, two principal professors. And what they point out is that when the public agrees with the wealthy, then things happen. When the public disagrees with the wealthy, if anything happens, it's what the wealthy want.
Exactly. And frankly, it's not just about money and politics. And that was, that's a key point that people have to understand. When people have to wait hours upon hours to vote, or if there aren't polling locations anywhere near their places of residency, or if they can't vote because of a voter ID law because they lack the proper form of identification, when they can't vote in a district that is fairly drawn, or when the map is rigged by the politicians that control the maps. These are examples of a representative system that is not working. And the anger is just very, very clear. It's not a surprise that Donald Trump was able to capitalize on virtually the same rhetoric about the system being broken as Bernie Sanders.
That's right.
Drain the swamp is not that different from the system is rigged. And, 85% of Americans want fundamental change in the way we fund our elections. 75% of Americans feel that they themselves have too little influence in Washington, D.C. Overwhelming supermajorities are angry and alienated. The system is broken. People do not feel like they're being heard.
Steve Bannon, in his 60 Minutes interview, one of the most striking things was, I think, the very last lines when he said, there will be a populist revolution. The question is whether it will be from the left or from the right.
Yes, and that's why we are focusing on a democracy movement, of really making it visible, feeding it every way we can, and celebrating and building it, because we strongly believe that exactly that. If people are just fearful, and there are now new studies out that prove this, that if fear takes over, then people move to the strong man.
Right.
And they become much more narrow in their views. And so a sense of possibility, by the way, we like to call ourselves possibilists. We're not optimists or pessimists, but we're possibilists. That is the greatest antidote to fear, which turns people to give up and give over their power to the strong man.
Right.
Yeah, and just very quickly, we just want to say that we truly see that the election of Donald Trump was a result of this feeling of powerlessness. It's not a surprise that people wanted to throw a brick into the Beltway glass. People were angry, people were alienated, and they wanted to try something new. It's not a surprise. And I'm sure this is the next thing you'll want to talk about, but, the reason we are today, where we are today, is because of a long, concerted, deliberate effort we try and give it a name, the anti-democracy movement, that has really pushed us in this direction where most people, or virtually the supermajority of people in America, have no political power. The reason that Donald Trump was elected is because of the circumstances that was created by this anti-democracy movement.
Right. And we will talk about that next. I want to make a couple of comments. One is that I think what you say, that people will gravitate toward a strong man when they are angry and fearful. I think the other thing that happens is, and you sort of mentioned it, is that a number of people resign themselves, become cynical, and drop out of the process, leaving the playing field for those whose passions are most ignited. In other words, when elections, which of course are not democracy, they are just an occasional aspect of democracy, but elections are determined by turnout. And when you can turn off people, then the people with the biggest passions, as I say, which might be fear, might be anger, will win the day. And what we have to do, and what you're working toward in this is to ignite those passions towards something positive rather than against the system, and ending with that. Let's shift to the second question, which is, as you say, this concerted effort. How did our democracy get broken? What's the history? Who are the culprits? What is the Powell memo?
Okay, before we get to the Powell memo and the anti-democracy movement per se, I just want to ground us in the economic mythology of our country that has created so much suffering that people are vulnerable then to this fear message. That we call it brutal capitalism is where we are. We describe a whole history in a few paragraphs of how Americans have absorbed this reductive notion that human beings, all we can count on is that we are self-interested. We are driven by material, acquisitive material drive and selfishness, and that's what we can count on. And so we buy into this notion. Ronald Reagan told us it was magic, it's the magic of the marketplace, that if we turn over our fate to this, that it will sort out outcomes fairly. And what happens then, we turn over our fate to a market, but there is no such thing as free market. That's a fiction. What we have in America today is a one-rule market that is highest return to existing wealth. So wealth accumulates to wealth, accumulates to wealth until a tiny handful today of Americans control as much wealth as the bottom half of us. And that's untenable. And then that, of course, then infects and infuses and distorts the political process. And so it's this form of brutal capitalism that we say creates our culture of blame and shame and divides us, because people are so struggling and looking for some way to understand. And it's very easy to blame others, and whether they be immigrants or people of color, who they imagine have gotten something they haven't. So I always want to come back to that core idea that is also part of the limits of our imagination, that we believe we can have such a thing as a democratic economy, a democratically bounded market that has public values of decency and fairness in it fundamentally in the mix. And so we are not anti-market. We are anti this false idea of a one-rule market that only where everything is about highest return to existing wealth that can't succeed. So that being said, then
let me jump in for 1 second, Francis.
Yes,
and
please.
Two things. One, what I hear there also from you is the narrative side, right? In other words, if you want to look at how things get broken and how things get fixed, it's good to see the long-term narrative. And that's why your narrative starts before politics. It starts in economics. The second thing is I see it, you echoing the discovery you made in the Berkeley Library that it's not scarcity. It's the stories people are told and the stories people believe, and this economic, as you say, brutal capitalism injects scarcity. It doesn't arise from it.
Creates the experience of scarcity for so many, which then reinforces this idea that we're all just these self-indulgent shoppers, right?
Yep.
So it's a self-perpetuating, reinforcing spiral of powerlessness, we call it. So that then sets us up for 1971, actually the same month that Diet for a Small Planet was published. Lewis Powell was really worried. While people like me who'd been part of the war on poverty and so excited that I helped cut the poverty rate in half in a little more than a decade, I was excited to be part of the women's movement and civil rights movement, all that good stuff. Well, not everyone was thrilled. And Lewis Powell soon-to-be Supreme Court justice. He was on a number of corporate boards, including tobacco companies, and he was worried. He was really worried that the free enterprise system was under such attack that it was a life and death struggle. He uses words like they destroy us, they're destroyed, they want to destroy the system. And so the Chamber of Commerce asked Lewis Powell to basically prepare some guidance for how does the business community, which Powell says in his responses, you know, it's the most undervalued or unlistened to, effectively, segment of society. He wrote then a 34-page memo, very clear, very sharp, and it reads like a playbook, Terrence, in terms of what then happened, how the business community, if you will, proceeded.
And there are basically two main categories that came out of the Powell memo, and then a cabal of billionaires took up the mantle as well and then added to this playbook. And basically, so what came out of it, what became the framework of what we call the anti-democracy movement, two big categories. The first, manipulate the mindset. The second, rig the rules. So what do we mean by manipulating the mindset? What we mean is we have to alter the way Americans think about the economy and government. And so that means the handful of billionaires and corporations start funding at a massive rate think tanks. Heritage Foundation and Cato Institute are probably two of the best examples. Think tanks that will disperse white papers and public policies that, you know, suggest that the only thing we can do to make our society work is turn everything over to the, quote, free market, even though we know that's a myth. So privatize everything. Make sure that government can't function. Funding chairships and professorships at universities that teach fringe subjects or were then fringe, like law and economics, which tried to infuse the rational self-interest of the Milton Friedman-style economic theory into the legal field. They funded chairships at Harvard and the University of Chicago. They also altered text. They funded textbooks for grade school to grad school. And the list goes on and on and on. Alter the way the media works. Allow for consolidation of media. Get rid of the fairness doctrine. Appoint FCC commissioners that did not believe in the public good of airwaves. And one of our favorite examples, and what we think is probably the most potent, is delegitimize government itself. So whether through think tanks producing policy or white papers that show government is, quote, inefficient, or just making the function of democracy or of government not work. So one of the examples we love to use is Newt Gingrich, who said that the partisan fight has to be fought with the scale, duration, and savagery of civil war. And he became Speaker of the House in 1994. So politics is war. And you see that in the Obama era, where the filibuster is used at an unprecedented rate, just literally making government unable to function, where you see the government shutdown costing the taxpayers $24 billion. So, of course, faith in our democratic institutions and government itself plummets. And when that happens, people are much more willing to hand over their faith to a free market because government doesn't work. And so you see that over and over again, that we have to reshape the way Americans think about democracy and economics. And it was deliberate.
Okay, let me mention a couple of things to just fill out the context of the point at which the Powell memo was written. Francis, you referred to the poverty, the anti-poverty movement, but I think some of the other things that Powell was looking at was Ralph Nader, and the concept of consumer protection, and the fact that Richard Nixon, they fought a hard-fought election in 1968. Nixon wins, and then again in 72, and yet what you have is Nixon signs the Environmental Protection Agency. He signs the OSHA, occupational safety measures, and this, I think, is the kind of thing that has Powell going, wait a minute, you know, everything's moving against us. Okay, so I just want to set up that context. Second thing I want to say is that I remember the Powell memo first came to me, and I just want to give her a heads up, was a woman named Sally Covington in 1989 who wrote for the Center for Responsive Philanthropy, and she really laid out the same case that you lay out here in the book Daring Democracy. Now, having said that, I highly recommend to folks, if this is news to you, if the actual battle plan laid out and then executed over the years since 71, Daring Democracy has the most concise and complete, I think, description of how that happened. And along the way, we learn about ALEC. And we learn about the Federalist Society, ALEC to lobby governments and actually write model legislation, which then gets passed by state legislatures, and the Federalist Society to vet prospective justices so that the federal government, the federal justice system, and judges throughout the country share its point of view. Anything you want to add to either of those?
Yeah, very quickly. And then just kind of the second real key piece of this is the rigging of the rules. So when you can't alter all of the, you know, all of America's mindset, especially for those who are going to be most hurt by this economic system, this anti-government system that turns everything over to the private sector, you have to just rig the rules, make sure that the people who are going to be most hurt can't actually express themselves politically. And so this is really where the anti-democracy movement has been probably the most successful, passing voter ID laws, suppressing the vote, getting rid of polling locations, unleashing money in politics, rigging the lines so that politicians can choose their constituents and not the other way around. And the story of the gerrymandering, it was really an assault on fair lines after the 2010 elections is really stunning. And the journalist Dave Daly wrote a wonderful book about that. And we tell the story in brief and just how deadly and devious the plot to rig the elections or the district lines were in 2010. And so we really go through it, that the rigging of the rules is a really key piece of this whole thing.
Absolutely. And some things along the way, Buckley versus Vallejo, Citizens United, and then all of the gerrymandering that followed in state legislatures when I think this movement had its greatest sort of success that almost went unnoticed, which was the 2010 elections. Obama having won a wonderful victory in 2008, and then in 2010, as we've mentioned this show many times, a key election because districts are set every 10 years, but only every 20 years are districts set after a non-presidential election. And so 2010 was both a non-presidential election, which means you don't get as many progressive votes, as many urban votes as you do in a midterm election. And yet that midterm election set the stage for all of the gerrymandering that took place following that. Okay. Again, turn to this book, 163 pages. It will lay out that case. So now we've answered how do we know it's broken and how did it get broken in brief. Now, how do we fix it? What are the solutions? And for this one, jump in with specific examples. We've got about 8 more minutes.
Okay. Let me just do one preface comment, and that is that it is not the magnitude of the challenge that crushes the human spirit. It's only feeling useless, feeling futile. And so our book is to show exactly true stories that we are not powerless. We can act effectively. And so we go through the stories of people who most inspired us. And one state is the state of Maine, where in 1996, Mainers were really upset about the trucking industry lobby that had overwhelmed and caused a lot of harm. And so they said, okay, we're going to institute public financing of elections, and we've got to pass this system to make it work where you step up as a candidate and you get a small number of small donations from a certain number of people, and then you get public matching, you know, you get public funds to go for it. Well, the campaign started, and they reached out to a polling outfit to say, would you poll this question? And the polling outfit said, no, it would be unethical for us to do that, to take your money, because you have no chance of winning. Well, in 1996, 12% advantage over the naysayers, and they went forward with clean elections in Maine. And so that now, I believe it's up to back up around 80% of legislators in the Maine legislature have run using public money. So people like my friend Deb Simpson, a waitress in a small town in Maine, could run and win 5 times and become a distinguished leader. And now there are more members of the working class percentage-wise in the Maine legislature than any other state.
Okay, and very, very quickly, if you're under the Maine model and it's you know spreading, it's how do you qualify? Just so people who have a question about that, how do you qualify for the public money?
Well, Deb had to get, this was year 2000, she had to get $5 from 50 people to show that she was a viable candidate. And she said, I'm a waitress, I can do that. And she did.
I know how to get tips, exactly. So you show that you have support, and then that puts you in a position to gain the public support. Okay, Adam,
correct.
I cut you off. Go ahead.
Oh, no, as you say, and that depends on which race you're running for. And there are many different models of public financing across the country. One of them that's most exciting now, which we really didn't even talk about in the book, is Seattle, which very quickly they give every resident of Seattle four $25 vouchers that they can give to any of the municipal candidates that they want, the ones that are eligible. In 2017, this past election was the very first one to use these vouchers, and it was a tremendous success. The number of donors tripled. The donors reflected the actual demographics of Seattle, and the candidates that used the public money won against big money-backed candidates. And you see this across the country, that when there's significant public financing, the amount of time people spend fundraising goes way down, and that normal, ordinary, everyday Americans can run for office and have a political voice. But here's the thing. It's not just about money and politics that we're making progress. I'm going to make a very bold claim here, and I think it's one that Frankie agrees with, and I think it's one that our book supports. We have the policy solutions to advance our democracy. We know what we need to do. And there are states across the country that have been experimenting in pro-democracy policy, from early voting to same-day registration to one of my favorites, which is automatic voter registration, so that you get registered every time you interact with a government agency or an eligible government agency like the DMV. And Oregon became the first state to implement AVR in 2015. And in the first 3 months, when it went into effect in 2016, registration tripled. The new registrants tripled in the first 3 months. And so you see outstanding progress, almost 100,000 new voters in Oregon. And since Oregon passed it, 9 states in Washington, D.C. have followed suit passing AVR, and 1 in 4 Americans now live in a state with automatic voter registration.
That's what's often called motor voter, which is just their shorthand for you interact with the DMV, you register to vote. But you're saying that it's broader than that.
States are now, states with AVR are now looking to expand it. Rhode Island, for example, is in the process of expanding it, to figure out what are the other agencies, like welfare offices, or, I've actually heard that some people are looking to implement that within community colleges.
Right, I was thinking education, of course. Everyone interacts with education. Very, very good.
And these are just small, these are very practical measures that we know work. Or, here's one that, very quickly, pre-registration for 16 and 17-year-olds, that if you allow people to pre-register, they're much more likely to vote.
When they reach the age where they can.
When they reach voting age.
Yeah.
That when you allow young people to get integrated into the system earlier, they're much more likely to participate when they're of age. That's such a common sense reform that has major implications. And you see that in many different examples in our book. And you see people pushing it on a state level, winning, and then with each victory, we get even more data showing it works. And so this is what we talk about when we say there's growing momentum. Because we have more and more of these cases where it's working and people are being inspired, and that there's even more grassroots effort across the country pushing for these reforms that we know work.
Well, as you point out, on Election Day 2016, which most people or many people who are listening right now felt, was a black day, 14 of 17 state and local pro-democracy ballot initiatives passed.
Correct. When it's on the ballot, it wins. I mean, with very few exceptions. I mean, one of our favorites is South Dakota. South Dakota was one of the states that have a ballot initiative, a pro-democracy ballot initiative. It was one of the most sweeping pieces of anti-corruption legislation in South Dakota. And South Dakota has voted for Republicans in 80% of all statewide elections in its state's history. And it voted for one of the most sweeping pieces of anti-corruption legislation. And the legislature ended up repealing it, but they're now citizens are mobilizing again to try and put it on to the state constitution in 2018.
Let me just say, in California, one that we have is moving the choosing of districts, the setting of congressional and legislative districts away from the politicians themselves, which puts it to incumbent making things that put them in safe districts. California passed that, and now that movement of having independent commissions make these decisions following the next census is spreading throughout the nation, is it not?
Yes, and the California example we describe in the book, because it's so complex to make it really nonpartisan, it's brilliantly complex, and to the point, sort of at the end, it's a drawing out of the hat. And when we were in California recently on with our book tour, we were interviewed by someone who actually participated himself in the feedback. The California process allowed people to give direct feedback to the decision makers about the district lines, and he said, "Well, I'm not sure I like this. It doesn't fit my community. How about that?" And they had the technician show it up on the screen, and the commission ended up agreeing with him. So not only is it a much better process of avoiding partisan districting, but it's actually been a very participatory process as far as we could tell. And another state that we don't often think of as a trailblazer that passed one of those 14 out of 17 was the state of Missouri. And they reinstated some contribution limits in for state offices. And while there was a challenge to part of it, the contribution limits held. And this was 70% voted in favor of these limits. So that's another example.
And now there's a new campaign for the 2018. There's already a ballot initiative underway to try and reinvigorate the laws in Missouri and basically kind of redo some of the parts that were overturned and make it even stronger. So you're seeing a proliferation, really, since we wrote the book. You see it in Missouri. You see it in Pennsylvania with folks called March on Harrisburg, trying to do a similar democracy spring model in the state to pass a gift ban and gerrymandering reform. You see it in Washington State. You see it across the country, and it's extremely exciting. In virtually every state, there's some sort of movement for democracy.
Okay. Now, you guys, basically, I'm going to give you each 30 seconds to say the last thing you want to say to listeners right now. And I will just preface it by saying you suggest that courage and democracy are both contagious.
Absolutely. And I believe that all of us want to be heroes to ourselves. If nobody else, we want to know that we stepped up. We don't want to be there on that the cliche deathbed thinking, oh, I wish I could. And this is the moment. And so for us, that's why we speak of the thrill of democracy, that it meets these essential human needs to count, you know, to have power, to have a real voice, to connect with others in common purpose. And so this is not a you should. This is what we're saying, that this is a thrilling part of human dignity. It is the essence of human dignity, in fact.
And I want to take my 30 seconds to speak to any young listeners. I'm only 24, but one of the things that I've realized about this democracy movement is just how welcoming it is of young people. Not only are young people welcome, but they're given leadership positions and the ability to really make the change themselves. And that's been one of the most rewarding things. It does not matter how old you are, you can be a part of this movement and be welcomed and make a difference. And if there are any young people listening who don't think they have a voice, I want you to reconsider that, because you do. I've experienced it in this movement, and I say jump in and make a difference, because if we're going to win this, it's going to be on the back of our generation. It's our future at stake, and we need to step up.
Very good. Okay, stay on the line so we don't hear that terrible clicking sound. So again, the websites are smallplanet.org, that's small planet, one word, and fieldguidetodemocracy.org. And let me add one more, SPIFastFacts.org, SPI Small Planet Institute, SPI Fast Facts. They have gathered about 4,300 at this point facts that illustrate this with numbers and data, things that you can use. The book is Daring Democracy, Igniting Power, Meaning, and Connection for the America We Want. Thank you, Francis Moore LePay and Adam Eichen. Keep up the good work.
Thanks so much. That was
terrific.
Okay, you're very welcome. For this conversation and many other interviews, articles, transcripts of interviews, and to join me in pursuit of a world that just might work, go to terrencemcnally.net or aworldthatjustmightwork.com. They're the same website. If you want to receive weekly email announcements telling you who's going to be on, what we're going to talk about, and usually 5, 6, 7 relevant articles Email me at temcnally@mac.com. You can also sign up at my site. You can also subscribe and listen to the Free Forum podcast on iTunes. You can find years of podcasts at my site or at iTunes anytime, anywhere. You can listen to Michael Lewis, Jeremy Scahill, Robert Reich, Connie Rice, Van Jones, Greg Boyle. Finally, thanks to G, my engineer, George Vassilopoulos at Progressive Voices, Mark Maxwell in production. Most of all, you, my listeners, please share this podcast widely.